Hello and welcome to the AI Future Show with me, your host and guide, Professor Andy Pardo.
Today's episode is a recording from our very first live show.
One of the challenges that I see overall, and this is what gave birth to Scaled Insights, is that we're very busy analyzing humans using artificial intelligence and big data and all of that stuff. But what we're kind of doing, a lot of what we're doing is really like rowing a boat where you're going forward, but you're facing backwards. So a lot of what we do is using historical data to analyze humans. So being an industrial psychologist, I was a little frustrated, and somebody who's been involved in technology since 1989. I'm a little frustrated by that because I've been involved in technology and big data literally since the early 90s. And I felt that there's always something missing, which is the humanity. And so what we did is we started looking at systems and processes that existed in the offline world that help humans understand what other humans are like. So the best basic example would be a Rorschach test, where I show you a picture and you tell me it looks like the angel of death or it looks like a beautiful butterfly. And your answer tells me a lot about who you are and how you see the world. So as humans, we do this inherently, and you experience this literally if you went in for psychoanalysis or anything like that, where they're not necessarily listening to what you say, but how you say it. And you're doing that with me right now. I'm talking and you're building an impression of who I am as a person. And then what we tend to do as humans is, oh, I remind you of your friend Ralph. And so now you've built a predictive model of how I will behave because you know how Ralph behaves because you know him a lot more intimately than you know me. So my question was, could we use AI to actually do something quite similar? Could we analyze human speech and start understanding personality behind it? And starting literally in the late 50s, there was work that was done around this. That's all around neuro-linguistic pattern analysis. So what they're doing is they're looking at the patterns, because when you speak out of your subconscious. You're not really thinking, you're just flowing language. And so we often, like probably anybody who's ever had a mother, which I think is everybody, has been in a situation where you've been told in Canada it would be the garbage or the trash, and in UK it would be the rubbish, where your mother says, "Will you please take out the rubbish?" And you say, "I guess so." And then you're wondering why your mother, or it could be your spouse, is upset with you. Because "I guess so" is actually leaking an emotion that's behind, or a concept that's behind the words. "I guess so" really doesn't say, "I'm really excited to do this." It's actually saying, "Yeah, if you're going to make me." And when you think about it in that context, our thought was, could we analyze language and then start putting people into categories and understanding their behaviors so that you can actually link that with big data? So ultimately, what we need to do is we need to reduce a human personality down into a numerical score so that it can be number crunched along with the other big data. Because if you said, "I'm a Ralph," and you've got 12 other Ralphs, that's really difficult to plot. You know, what's the graph for that? But if you say I'm a number 17, and that represents this dot here on the graph, you can then understand that, and then you can start comparing that with other big data. And to me, that's the opportunity where we start bringing humanity into the data. When people talk about the risks of AI, one of the challenges is that we go back to like Terminator, you know, where the computers decide that humans are too dangerous and they should just wipe them out. Well, arguably, if you're going to use AI to study global warming and the AI was really good, it would say get rid of humans because humans cause global warming. You know, we're the root cause when you think about it. We burn fossil fuels. If you said, "Oh, it's cows," and the cow farts and burps, well, it's because humans eat the cows that we have so many cows. So at the end of the day, you do that. So what we have to do is we have to put the humanity back into it and say, how do we analyze the problem from a human standpoint? So The solution for global warming isn't to get rid of humans, because we would find that unacceptable. But maybe it is to change people's perceptions and behaviors so that we act more responsibly. So maybe we should be eating less cows, or maybe we should be raising cows differently, or maybe we should be 3D printing meat, or like all of these different possibilities come out as we think about it alongside the human condition. Because I'll tell you something, I'm a carnivore. And if you told me I couldn't eat meat, I don't know if I want to live. So I need my barbecue. So you're not gonna shift me. What you're gonna do is you're gonna nudge me. And this is where we believe our technology really comes into its best.
What's your take on doing this type of analytics, especially in the current environment with privacy and the ethics that seems to be very much on the radar at the moment? Are you getting any resistance, and how are you dealing with those types of issues?
I wouldn't say resistance. And the big thing is that we actually don't need to know who you are. It's actually quite unimportant for us. Like, we don't need to know it's Professor Andy Pardo. What we need to know is that there's a cluster of people who are like Andy, who think about things in a certain way. So maybe one of the things we could talk about is we just did a large scale COVID study in the UK. And we were looking at, we basically did a survey asking for some natural language, which is what we process. So we need 300 to 500 words of natural language. And then we asked you some questions. And the questions really became the big data that went behind it. And what we were looking at was your personality versus your behavioral and risk attitude. And the thought really was, could we determine that people with certain personalities have certain risk profiles that they find comfortable? And then if you could determine that, then you could actually look at it and say, okay, how would you talk to this cluster of people so that you would impact them? Because typically what we do is we have a one-size-fits-all approach towards everything in our world. And the one-size-fits-all approach is not, like, yes, it's effective, but it's not incredibly effective. And examples would be how many of us right now have a Coke in our hand? Yet Coca-Cola spends billions of dollars every year advertising Coke, trying to get us to nudge towards Coke. They do enormous amounts of market research. They do everything they possibly can. And yet, if you talk to Coke right now, they would say that they're trying to get more into personal marketing and figuring out how to get affinity markets going. And they're focused on trying to make that message much more relevant to you specifically. And when you look at it in that context, that's exactly what our technology does. But we don't need to know who you are. We just need to know which cluster you fall into. So I fall into the middle-aged redhead man cluster, for example. So if you want to get me to drink Coke, you might have to activate me with some message like, you know, the caffeine will give me more energy to write reports or something. Whereas someone else may be motivated by something totally different.
Do you think in the future that there's a way that this will extend to the point where it might become a very personalized profiling, and it would take in more real-time context about me? Because having a personality type is one thing, but whether context of what's going on around me at the time might also affect my decision making. Do you see that coming in the future as well?
Yes, very much so. I see a future. So we already have this happening. And so whenever I talk to people and they have a, oh my God, kind of reaction, I always say, well, hold on a second. Do you read your news online? Are you using Google News or Apple News or Flipboard or one of those products? Well, it's already shaping your news. If you're a conservative, and we're seeing this more and more, we saw this in Brexit, we've seen this in the rise of Trumpism in the US, where people are only receiving news within their bubble. And so we're already using technology to do that. The problem is that the technology is essentially dumb. It's making its best guess based on what other people do, but it's not actually looking at me as a person and saying, how do I behave? How do I How do I see the world around me? How would I react? So right now, there's some great examples like the Black Lives Matter movement, which has resonated literally around the world, where we're seeing people who are actually theoretical Trump supporters and very conservative are changing their point of view in light of Black Lives Matter, because I'm not sure if the word is humanitarian, but they have a much more social outlook. It's just they're politically conservative. And now those two things are at a crossroads, and they're actually being forced to make a choice. And I think that as we can start understanding people better, we can start communicating with them for the better, if we do it right. So we're looking at things like, how do we get you to take your drugs? So an example in the UK, if you're male and over 50 and you've been diagnosed with high cholesterol and high blood pressure, you'll be put on cholesterol drugs, a statin, and some sort of beta blocker, or ACE inhibitor or something that is a blood pressure lowering drug. The chances of you taking the drug after 90 days are actually 50-50, believe it or not. If you thought about it in the terms of the NHS, pays for your open heart surgery and your diabetes and all the other health problems and strokes and things that go along with not managing these things, it's so much more expensive for you not to take those pills. So the question is, how do we get you to take those pills? Well, your reasons to take the pills are different than my reasons to take the pills. And so if we could understand each other better, and understand what's going on and how we see the world, we could then shape the message. So I like the analogy of, we have a 30-year-old Donald Trump and a 30-year-old Mahatma Gandhi. And let's assume that they each have a 2-year-old daughter. So you've got a 2-year-old Indira and a 2-year-old Ivanka. What would you say to Mahatma Gandhi to get him to take his drugs versus what would you say to Donald Trump? And for Mahatma Gandhi, I would argue that it was his worldview was more outside of his own person. So based on this outside of his own person thinking, you might say to him, because he's 30 and thinks he's invincible, you might say, look, you need to take care of yourself now. Imagine how devastating it would be for Indira if you weren't able to walk her down the aisle when you're in your 50s. And yet for Donald Trump, he's more about himself. And there's a great clip going around now of Ivanka describing Donald as being more about himself. So I think we could all acknowledge it. And you would say to him, you need to take care of yourself. Imagine how horrible it would be for you if you couldn't walk Ivanka down the aisle. So it's the exact same message, but with a nuance. And the technology's availability is there. So we could analyze this. The question is, do we actually have the AI to do it? And that's why we built what we built, so that we could actually start understanding these nudges and then helping people. So I imagine one day your smartwatch will notice you walking into McDonald's and saying, you know what, maybe you should be making a healthier choice today. But it'll say it in a way that will actually resonate with you. So instead of saying, maybe you should be making a healthier choice, it might say, hey, you're going to Tenerife. You better look good in that Speedo, Andy. Or for somebody else, it could say, you're getting married next month and you want to fit into the wedding dress. So these things and how we say it would vary based on who we are, where we are. Trying to use data to properly understand humans, because one of the challenges that we have is that we make assumptions about people's behaviors. And these assumptions are not based on maths. They're based on really stereotypes. And it's very dangerous. And we see it. We're starting to see it more as we look at what's happening in the world today, where we're challenging more and more stereotypes. But I like the analogy of, you know, when you're driving on the highway, or motorway, I guess, in England, and someone passes you, they're a madman. And if somebody's holding you up and not driving fast enough, they're an idiot. Yeah. And yet one of these people is more conservative and one of these people is more aggressive. And you're making judgments on them based on their observed behavior. What you haven't read into it, though, is why they have this behavior. And for all you know, the madman might be in a hurry because their wife is about to give birth, or they're maybe about to lose their job and they've been held up behind one of these slow people, or all of these different things. And so as we start to understand each other and back up our behaviors with maths and start saying, okay, you're part of a cluster, we understand who you are and how you think, and we can prove this out, we can start looking at people a lot more compassionately. Because the challenge right now is that we look at people and we'll go, oh, well, he's a Brexiteer, or she's a Ramoner, or whatever it is. And based on these assumptions, we then broad brush everybody. And what we're proving out as we do this analysis is that there's subclusters. And as you start looking at subclusters, like I fall into the cluster of men over 50. But if you look at men over 50, there's men over 50 who, you know, jump out of airplanes, and there's men over 50 who, you know, knit and stay home and, you know, worry about stuff. So you, by calling me a man over 50, you haven't really said enough about me.
The data will always have inherent bias in it to a degree. It's how we build the AI systems to deal with that, I think, is quite an interesting one.
I agree. And I think that we start taking bias out of it when we start looking at personality and stop looking at the tombstone data that is just so often found in our world. So I may have the same attitude as a woman in her 40s for some things. And there's no reason to make an assumption that because I'm male, I have certain attitudes or behaviors, or because I'm white, I have certain attitudes or behaviors. So really, I think that one of the challenges that exists right now is that we as a society are very fast to stereotype people into categories and then start saying, oh, this is who you are. So when we talk about data bias, I always look at it and say human bias. I was at a conference. I was one of the speakers at a conference of lawyers in Canada, one of the largest ones, who were talking about AI and ethics. And they were talking about the problem, you know, with insurance underwriting using AI. And they said, you know, it could have biases. It could be the blah, 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 blah. And my comment was, okay, maybe it does, but those biases are systematic. So it's uniformly applying those biases across everybody. And as a result, you can find them, identify them, and change the system. And if you change the system, you change it for everybody. I asked the question, who has looked at insurance adjusters? There's probably hundreds that work for every insurance company, and done a survey to find out what their implicit biases are.
Do you believe there are methods to actually measure the data bias that an algorithm exhibits? Is there a way to measure that, do you believe?
I think that there are a number. I think it really varies based on how you would approach it and what data you're analyzing. So, you know, for example, if you had a standardized set of people, and let's say 50% of them were men and 50% of them were women, and you ran them through the AI and you realized that it only had selected men, it would be very obvious about the gender bias. So I think that a certain amount of it is this, is a question, maybe I could describe this best with a Netflix example. So Netflix came out with, like, when you go to Netflix, you see the cover art for all of the movies. And what you don't know is that Netflix actually selects certain of that imagery. As a matter of fact, I believe they're doing it less now because they've had so many problems with it. But they were doing a lot of it before. And they were selecting that cover art based on your viewing history and your proclivities. So the challenge was that this was built in Silicon Valley by a bunch of probably white and Asian AI engineers who took a data set and did intense machine learning and then tested it out, probably on themselves. And what they didn't realize is that there are subsections of movie culture that are natural. They exist. It's not racially one way or another way. But for example, there's a lot of movies that have full black casts and black actors and black stars, just staying on our Black Lives Matter example. And if you're black, those movies probably resonate with you, just like movies that star Ed Sheeran probably resonate with me. And we like to see people who look like us in the movies. That's why I watch Brad Pitt movies. What was happening was that the people who watched a lot of black movies, black themed movies, were getting examples. And my favorite example of this was Good Will Hunting, which is a movie a lot of people have seen. There's a black janitor in it. He's got like a minute of screen time, maybe 2 minutes of screen time, and probably about 10 lines. But if you watched a lot of black themed movies, you actually got him as the keyframe of the movie. And the problem was not that the algorithm wasn't working correctly, because the algorithm basically said, show the person what they like to see the most. And if you watch a whole bunch of black themed movies, then that means you like black actors. So it goes through a movie that's what, a 90 minutes long plus, and it finds you the one black actor in it and it shows it to you. Yeah. It's done a perfect job, but it's done a crappy job from a human standpoint. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it was considered to be, there was whole tweets going on and stuff. This was about almost 2 years ago now, that Netflix was racist and blah, blah, blah. It wasn't that Netflix was racist. It was that they unleashed an algorithm into the world without fully testing it.
Just a really big thank you to Stuart for being our first sort of guest on the show. It's been a fantastic conversation. And as always, I really appreciate the chats that we've had over the years, and I'm sure that will continue.
If you like this show, it would be great if you could follow and share on social media. All of our links are available on pardo.ai. Thank you for listening to this episode of the AI Future Show. I hope you've enjoyed it and will take the time to rate it and to share with your friends, family and colleagues. Also, don't forget to check out other episodes of the show. To find out more about me, visit pardo.ai. Are you an AI-related company and would like to sponsor one of the episodes or a full series of the AI Future Show? If so, please contact me on my website.